this week on Out of the Air features Bill Dahl, who began writing music professionally in the 1977, receiving a Grammy nomination in 1998 for his liner notes. Next, Kentucky-based artist and educator Jason Sturgill, whose loose style of watercolor leaves rough drawing lines as his recipe for the final work. Our spotlights on Duneland Photography Club's February exhibit at the Chesterton Art Center.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself and show the world your...
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP, 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. I'd like to welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight from the Duneland Photography Club, the longtime president of it. He's going to talk about some upcoming things that are happening for them and things that they've just done. Steve Bensing, who is the president. Welcome, Steve, back to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Well, it's good to be here, Larry and Esther. It's good to see you here, too.
Yeah, it's always good to see you.
Yes. It's always fun to be here.
So you have an exhibit coming up, but maybe we would talk about... First, before you get into that, that'll be in February, some of the things you have been doing, like in December, January, and things like that, and even earlier if you want, and then we'll get move on to the exhibit.
Oh, sure. There's been a lot going on. You know, we do different events. You know, just a couple of things we did around the holidays was we had Tuba Christmas, which was at Valparaiso University, and got a chance to photograph that. We were asked by Amy Tomasek over there. To do it. We also did a photo shoot of Santa with kids, and that's always a fun time, especially the ones that are a little bit apprehensive of being at Santa Claus's lap. So all of those are good. We've had, of course, we had various photo shoots. We just went out for a winter one on Saturday, and we'll have some more coming up for outdoor things to enjoy the weather. In the wintertime, we got to enjoy all the seasons.
You had the marvelous Christina as a guest speaker. So it sounds, you know, what a lineup.
Yes.
To start the year.
Christina Kanowski came to our club and spoke about framing. And that's a very practical thing for the things that we have going on. We also had in February, our speaker was a fellow that comes from Michigan, but he wanted to, his name's Mark. I just met him recently, but his name is Mark Suggs. And he did a thing on printing. And printing could be printing photos at home or could be using services for that. So we learned a lot. We got some upcoming speakers, such as Amy Tomasek is coming to us in March. And Paul Ewing, who's the president of the Fernwood Photography Club in Niles, Michigan, is coming. And then in May, we have Susan Kurt. And I'd like to talk about Susan a little bit more. But she's one of our members, but she teaches at VU. She's an expert in biology, and she's working on some field guides for the field museum about the Indiana Dunes. So there's lots of stuff going on.
She's a marvelous photographer.
Yes, definitely.
So, Steve, just in case people are interested, and then we'll move on to what's upcoming, how can they become a member of the Photography Club? What do you do, when you meet, and things like that?
Okay, so we meet the first Tuesday of every month, and we meet at the Sunset Hill Farm County Park near the intersection of Meridian Road and US 6. We meet in what's some people call the silo or the grain bins, round metal building, the Horton Family Education Center. And we meet at 6 o'clock for a regular meeting. We meet, you can come early. We have mentoring. So we have people that come early to join, just show up. And it's $15 a year. You can't hardly go to Starbucks and spend less than that. So, you know, we really have a good deal. We have lots of different activities and events that I discussed a few of them.
Right. Well, you have an exhibit that's already opened at the Chesterton Arts Center. It opened in February 2nd, running through the 28th. But tell us about, I don't know if that one had a theme to it. I thought it might, I hope for a new season. And, you know, tell us all about the exhibit and everything.
Well, it's really a fun exhibit. It's been a couple of years since we've been to the Chesterton Arts Center. So it's a big show. We get to use the, you know, the all the space they have for the gallery. We have 23 members that participated in this exhibit. And this one, we decided to have a little bit of interest by deciding who would be the best of show in different awards. Leanne Angerman, who is a member of our club, but she's busy with other things. She's the Northwest Indiana Regional Director for Senator Jim Banks, who's a U.S. Senator from our state. And so she's got a lot of things on her plate, but she was so happy to judge the show for us.
And like I said, you will still have prizes for it?
Well, this is the first time that we've done our own this way. So the winners received a ribbon. In the past, we might even, in the future, we might have some monetary things. But right now, it's the pride of knowing how well you've done.
Right. That's great. And any other future exhibits coming up in our last minute here?
Okay. Well, we're going to have an exhibit at the Art Barn in the summer. And so we always look forward to that. And late fall, early winter, we're going to have an exhibit at the Village Gallery in Valparaiso.
Sounds great.
Oh, nice.
Well, it's a busy time. That's the Duneland Photography Club's exhibition, Hope for a New Season. It's running already open February 2nd through the 28th. Catch it at the Chesterton Arts Center on 4th Street here in Chesterton. And we'd like to thank Steve Bensing, president of the Duneland Photography Club, for coming on Art on the Air Spotlight.
Thank you.
Thanks. Have a great year, Stephen.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Sunday is brought to you by Ember Forge Consulting, with end-to-end expertise in learning strategy, design, and implementation. Ember Forge turns your organization's knowledge into impact. To learn more, visit emberforgeconsulting.com.
This is Janet Davies, formerly of ABC7 and now the Dunes Arts Foundation, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome Bill Dahl to Art on the Air. Bill has been a professional music journalist for almost 50 years. He has long specialized in writing liner notes, essays for reissue CDs focusing primarily on vintage rock and roll, blues, soul, doo-wop, rockabilly, and country material for just about every reissue label in existence. Bear Family and Sunset Boulevard are his two current main accounts. In 1998, Bill was nominated for a Grammy for his contribution to the notes on Rhino's box set, Ray Charles, Genius and Soul, the 50th Anniversary Collection. Bill won a Blues Music Award for compiling and annotating the 2013 four-volume series Plug It In, Turn It Up, Electric Blues 1939 to 2015, the definitive collection, which also won him a Living Blues Award as Producer of the Year. One of his latest CD projects for the Bear Family is Chicago Rocks, Windy City Rock and Roll, Volume 1. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Bill. Wonderful meeting you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, Bill, what we would like to do with all of our guests is find out their origin story. And how we set that up is by saying how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about Bill.
Well, I was born in Chicago. It's the only place I've ever lived. And two things, I guess, that really stood out is, A, my Uncle Joe was the jukebox king of Decatur, Illinois. So he would give me all these old beat-up 45s to listen to when I was like 3 or 4. So I would get all these Jerry Lee and Elvis and the Coasters and the Drifters and even Bobby Rydell and Freddie Cannon 45s, you know, to listen to on my little $29 record player. And that, I guess, is part of what instilled my love for rock and roll, 50s rock and roll, that I write about to this day. And the other part was my mother was a waitress at a joint called the Cairo Supper Club at Sheridan and Irving Park Roads on the north side of Chicago. So I was exposed to like live music when I was 4 or 5. Bill Scully and the Dynatones, Tony Smith and the Aristocrats, both of whom are on that CD you mentioned, Chicago Rock. And so that gave me a lot of background on, you know, what rock and roll sounded like live. And then when I was 13, I went to a high school downtown called Metro. And since I was going downtown every day, I'd take my lunch money and visit all those record stores downtown. Down on State Street alone, there must have been 10 places between the independent stores and Goldblatts and Montgomery Wards and Weebolts. And they all had great big album, selections, Woolworths.
Kind of grew up in Rose Records.
Oh, yeah, that was another one. That when I discovered the second floor of the one on Wabash with all those dollar albums, those unsealed dollar right. albums they had up there. I just went nuts, bought. And there was another one over there on Madison, and I'd go over there all the time too. And those were wonderful. So you had those, you had all these weird little independent stores that you wouldn't even notice hardly. And then one day, oh, what's that? My favorite, you know, where the cultural center is now, it was a combination record and porn store run by this very sleazy guy who had glued all these old 45s onto the window to get people's attention. And I saw a Harvey Fuqua 45 up there I'd really like to have. There were 3 for $1. And I went in and said, do you have any more of those? And he whipped it right off of the wall, off the window, leaving the label on the window glued. And he just hands it to me. And he goes, here you go. I've still got that 45 to this day, incidentally. And so I started going in there and buying. He had weird albums and weird 45s. And I would go in there and make them real nervous because I looked like I was about 14. I was really 16. And it was a very small doorway between one side and the other. I'm sure he thought I was going to sneak over there, but I wasn't. I just wanted the records, you know. So that was one of my favorite little stops. And and then I went to college at Columbia College, which is also downtown. So I just kept buying those records. And at Columbia, I studied journalism and radio. I thought I was going to be a big radio star playing my favorite old records, And when that didn't happen, I got into the writing thing more because I just knew how to write. That, you know, it was no great learned skill. It was just something that came naturally for me. I wrote for the school paper, started writing for neighborhood papers. Still no money, so we can't call that professional writing yet. And then there was this strange, short-lived publication called The Pulse in 1977. It had an office in a basement on Lincoln Avenue just north of Webster. And I went there and I got $6 for the piece about Lee Allen, the great New Orleans tenor sax player. And I was on my way somewhere. I'm not sure where. That was 1977. And I'm still doing it. And I'm still broke to this day, but that's okay. So here we are 50 years later. So I started writing for the Illinois Entertainer the next year and Living Blues magazine and Goldmine magazine. And just kept going from there. Freelance for the Tribune from 90 to 97. Still do an occasional piece for the Reader, which I went to from the Tribune. Do a dabble in radio still from time to time. But mostly I write liner notes. I've done probably 1,000 of those over the years for every reissue label you can think of. Like you said, Bear Family and Sunset Boulevard are the two main ones right now. I've been with them for a while. Sunset Boulevard and its predecessors, Fuel 2000, et cetera, all the way back to about 2000. And probably Bear Family as well. Yeah. So they keep me busy.
You know, that's kind of a lost art in this day and age is liner notes. When there were 12-inch albums, you know, there was plenty of space on the back to do that. And now, I mean, a lot of times they now insert them in the CD. So tell us about that transition from writing on, you know, 12-inch vinyl. And of course, vinyl is coming back. So that might be a good thing for liner notes. But, and the second part of that is, When you approach liner notes, what are you doing? I mean, what's the process for you to create that liner note?
Well, first, liner notes were awful on albums because you had no room. You had 600 words. It's basically the max they could squeeze onto one of those things. I routinely do 10 to 20,000 now, and with the box sets Bear Family puts out, I can do 50, 60,000, so that's more like a small book unto itself, which incidentally, I've written a few of those too, which I forgot to mention. Ghosted autobiographies about Cash McCall and Benny Turner, and back in 2001, I had Motown, The Golden Years, and 2017, The Art of the Blues. But liner notes, you're just writing a history of the artist, if it's a single artist. And if you're writing compilation notes like I do for Bear Family, those go a lot longer because let's say there's 32 acts on the thing. You've got to write about 32 different people, you know, and that takes time. You got to research 32 different artists, and that's basically 32 times as much work. So it takes a lot of, I'm working on one right now before I called you. That's what I was doing, is working on this thing, looking up an obscure hillbilly named Jimmy Swan and trying to put together a little one-page bio on him for his one song on the CD. The one artist compilations are a lot easier. You write 15 pages maybe about the one person. You really go deep about every song on the CD, and you try to do a good bio. For those box sets, I've done several on Bear Family, Freddie King, Hank Ballard and the Midnighters, Arthur Crudup. Those you can really go deep because you can write 50,000 words. So you really got to do interviews. Now, it's getting hard now because there's no one left to interview. They've all passed away from the 50s, you know, but when there were still people around, like I did a Wilson Pickett for Rhino Handmade once, and I must have interviewed 20 people for it. And it's a lot of work, but a lot of fun, too, because you get to talk to heroes.
Oh, I know. It must be really exciting.
That was the best part. When I started out, the world was my oyster. Everybody was still alive, you know, so I could interview Muddy Waters and B.B. King and Fats Domino and Bo Diddley and Sam and Dave and all that. As they've left us one after the other, it's gotten harder and harder to find first-person information anymore, so I work real hard to find a few people that are left, and they're getting very old, to be honest. I mean, I'm getting very old, so I wouldn't they get very older. And so it's a lot harder to pry a 90-year-old person's memory to get, you know, sometimes you have to remind them of the story you've read prior to that to get them to tell it to you again. If I've interviewed somebody 25 years ago and then I'm doing it again, it can be frustrating because they don't remember, you know, the same stories I told them back then. They try, but it's hard. So it's harder than ever to be an interviewer at this point. And really, contemporary blues, for the most part, with a few exceptions, doesn't interest me anymore. So I don't write about that like I used to. So, you know, I just quit writing for the last blues magazine I will ever write for. So no more of that. So, and by choice, I couldn't take it anymore. So, you know, it's just not worth doing. So I'll stick with the old stuff and I'll stick with the liner notes.
Well, you know, and there were only like, 35 tracks. So I'm sure there's volume 2, mm-hmm. 3, 4, maybe 5 in the works.
At least 3 that I know of. Yes, I'm working on volume 2 right now in this particular series, Chicago Rocks. Whole idea of these CDs is to show that Chicago had, in effect, a white rock and roll market as well back in the late 50s and early 60s. We all know about the blues and the soul and the doo-wop and the jazz, and I've written about all of it except the jazz. But we had 3 different tributaries, basically country guys, rockabilly guys that came up here from down south looking for work because we had about 10 times as many bars in those days where you could do live music. We had the teen idol guys trying to be the next Elvis, and we had lounge acts trying to pass as rock and roll when it became hot, and twist acts in the early 60s. Oh my golly, there were a lot of those. And, you know, so you had bars on Rush Street, and you had the Popples. Under 21 Tropicana Lounge, way out in the south suburbs. And that was where kids underage would go to drink these tropical drinks without booze in them, with little umbrellas in them, and listen to rock and roll. So a whole bunch of guys came out of that. Tobin Matthews and Steve King, who is now a famous WGN talk show host, and a lot of other folks would play out in these places. You had roller rinks, you had, little places out in the suburbs for kids to go, which they really don't have anymore, to go dance. And these acts would play there. So it's a very interesting scene to try to, because nobody's ever really documented it before. We had a guy named Jim Lounsbury here in Chicago that had his hands in as many pies as Dick Clark did, but nobody knows about him anymore, and it's a shame because he produced records. He had a show on WGN every day, did a lot of everything. He had a radio show, so he produced a lot of the stuff on this CD. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's, you know, and so many of the artists, they wrote their own songs, which is like Steve, who you mentioned, he wrote, and I really, you know, Lenny LaCour, I mean, he wrote for other people too. It's very exciting. But speaking about, Lenny, if we can talk about then Debbie Dean, do you know if she sounded different with each name she took on? I mean, or did
she unequivocally did. Prior to rock and roll, I haven't heard the one in 1950 on Aristocrat. That's just nowhere. But I assume it was just pure pop, you know, like a K-Star or a Patti Page or something. Then by 55, it's kind of brassy rock and roll, and she's kind of trying to straddle a fence between rock and roll and pop. And then in the late 50s there, that If You Can't Rock Me, she did for App. That's just straight, almost rockabilly. And then she went up to Motown, and she sounds like Motown in the earliest days. So, yeah, her sound just kept changing. She even did a couple of opening gigs on the infamous Winter Dance Party tour that Buddy Holly, the Big Bopper, and Richie Valens were killed on. And she opened for them up in Kenosha. And guess who the MC was? Jim Lounsbury. So there you go. But she ended up moving to L.A. And she had divorced Jim in 62 and ended up moving to L.A. And in 68, made another Motown single. By then, she was hooked up with a producer named Deke Richards, who was one of the main guys that produced the Jackson 5. And so she kind of made another stylistic change into more of a funky thing. So she was a chameleon, both with the names and the sound.
So, Bill, how involved are you in picking the order of the tracks? And do you find the photos?
Yeah, in the Chicago Rocks, I picked all the songs, but then, of course, you give the list to Bear Family, and they do what they have to get the rights to do it. Photos, I sent some of them, not all. Sometimes the artist has given me photos. I had done a story for Vintage Rock magazine over in England a few years ago about the same subject, so some of them had sent me photos, and I forwarded those to Bear Family, and then they find photos, too. But it varies, you know, on that. But yes, I chose all the songs and the order they're in and everything, trying to make it sound as good as possible. It isn't linear. I didn't want to do it that way because sometimes you do in different, you know, comps, but not on this one. But it's basically, I've got other ideas for the second one. I think I'll group all the twist ones together, make it a twist-a-thon. Excellent. Yeah, there's a lot of twist songs on the next one. Mm-hmm.
So with those 35, Bill, did you know all of them or did you find some as you were putting it together that you weren't aware of?
Yes, I found a lot. Somebody hit me to an act just last night that I didn't know about that I could put on volume 3, maybe. I'd never heard of before. But so I'm always open to more information. And as I interview people, they tell me more. Steve King and Phil Orsi and James Holvey have all been tremendous sources of information. And I really appreciate their help, you know, and their advice and everything. I'd like to transform this into a book someday. That would be the final step, going from the magazine article to the CD to a book. But that takes a lot more effort and everything, too. And you'd also have to find a publisher willing to publish something that esoteric, you know. So that can be difficult unto itself. But I'll try.
You know, just a compilation of your liner notes would be probably a wonderful thing. You give the context of the music and then everything, and that's really something. And, of course, approaching getting a Grammy nomination – a lot of people don't realize that there's a whole section in the Grammy Awards that's for historical, for album package, and that's included with liner notes. And they still offer that Grammy to this day.
Do they? And I used to be on a couple of those committees a long time ago, but I'm not anymore, so I don't know what's going on over there. But yeah, that was back in 98, the Ray Charles box set that Rhino had done. I just contributed one little piece about the horn players that Ray had back in the 50s, Fathead Newman, Hank Crawford, Leroy Cooper, et cetera, and interviewed a few of them for it. So I went there. It was a strange one because that was the one where that guy ran on stage in the middle of Bob Dylan's song with that soy bomb written on his chest and Dylan kind of just staring like he doesn't know what's going on. And then Aretha had to do Pavarotti's song, the aria, because he was sick and couldn't do it. And it was a strange May launch, but the after party was fun. They had all these different acts in this ballroom, like Joel Sonier and all kinds of different people. So that, Asleep at the Wheel. So that was a fun evening. But that's the only one I've ever been to. It was, what, geez, almost 30 years ago now.
What kind of music do you like now? You know, like, is there any, I'll say, contemporary type music that you like? I mean, you obviously have this whole historical love of music. And is there anything like you like that to listen to in the modern era here?
Nope, not a thing. I say the few people I like to listen to around here either do contemporary country, I mean, old-fashioned country music, Crazy Heart, for example, Kent Rose and the Remedies. There are several really good country bands in Chicago, and there's very little I like about contemporary blues other than the few people that are still left, like John Primer, for example. There is one young gentleman named Joey J. Say, who's terrific. He's only maybe 30 or so, but he has a terrific grasp of old-fashioned blues stuff, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s. I guess we'd call it traditional blues. And he's spectacular, but very few other people that I would go out of my way to see at this point in time. I'm just not into it. Blues has become watered down by rock to the point where it's undistinguishable for me. So that's one of the main reasons I got out of reviewing contemporary blues. It made me too depressed. Couldn't do it. Hurt my head.
So. You know, one of the artists that was new to me was Ernie Darrow, and he sounded as a bit of sound of the Stray Cats, you know, but then I read in your liner notes that he only did a couple things and then never recorded again.
Yeah, that was it, unless he recorded under some other name. That's the only 45 I know of that he did. The other side's called Car Hop. I don't know if we'll fit it on one of the future ones or not.
But yeah, he's like some of these guys.
Oh yeah, and then like some of these guys, like we just lost Hayden Thompson a couple of weeks ago. He just passed away, but he was on Sun Records in '57. Sun's subsidiary called Phillips International with a classic "Love My Baby" with Jerry Lee on piano, and then he came up here and settled in the Northwest suburbs and played up at a bar in Highwood there for about 12 years. And for a minute there, he almost became a country star. He had a record on Tap called $16.88. That was the price of a bus ticket in the song. And he almost made it. He was on local TV and everything here. But he was performing until a couple of years ago around here. And he was the real deal rockabilly all the way. So we had a few guys like that, Mizell and him, and a few others. Ron Haydock, who wanted to be Gene Vincent, was interesting. Ral Donner, who wanted to be Elvis, became a big star.
And he sounded like him. I mean, he really did have
very much
an Elvis-like tone. Voice.
Well, like his drummers told me, he said, "Why do you want to sound like Elvis?" And he goes, "I can't help it. I just do." And that was it. So that's the way it comes out. He just absorbed it, you know, from day one. And he made it big, although none of his big hits were cut in Chicago, which is why I didn't put them on there, because they were done in Miami and New York. So they don't really fit, you know. So, but that one session he did, the one we got on here, I Got Burned, that was done here in 62 down at Universal, which was Chicago's number one recording studio. It was down on Rush Street up above a liquor store, and it was state of the art. So that was the one that the people with money went to. Most of this stuff on this CD was not done at Universal, and you can, you know, kind of tell the difference. It was done in little tiny studios, you know, and garages and people's basements and stuff, and that's kind of what gives it its charm, I think, is the you know, the informality of it and everything. You got people in here like Ronnie Rice. That's his first single. He's still out there performing to this day. It is a one-man band thing, does 50s and 60s rock and roll really well. And
yeah, he's good.
Tony Smith, we just lost him a couple years ago, but he was performing here until about 2008. My golly, he was well into his 90s, and he was still playing drums. I went out and saw him a few times. He sounded great. And then others, I have no idea whatsoever, whatever happened to them. I'd love to find out, especially if they're still around so I could talk to them. But Eddie Bell and the Belairs, of course, Eddie became Eddie Blazonczyk and became the Polka King of Chicago, had won a number of Grammys. So
yeah, he also recorded a Lenny LaCourse tune.
Yes, he was a Lenny discovery, at least as a rock and roller. Yeah, Lenny was interesting because he moved up to Milwaukee for a while, and then he got hot. He got a few hits with Harvey Scales and the Seven Sounds, a really good soul singer out of Milwaukee. So he kind of changed his focus as a label owner.
You know, I have an odd question that I don't even know you if you'd know the answer to. So all of these groups, did they choose their own looks, or does the record label say you're going to look like this? Or do you know how that worked for them?
Yeah, back in those days, they were just who they thought they should be. You know, there was no grooming or anything of, you know, possible
no
stars.
No Rockabilly costume shop?
Nothing like that. No, like Frank Deaton, there's pictures of him, like that one in the thing where he's trying to look like Elvis, obviously. And guys like that, a lot of the teen idols fashioned themselves as Elvis, but because he was the guy, you know, so everybody wanted to be Elvis, unless they wanted to be Jerry Lee if they played piano, but that was who they wanted to be. As time went, the Beatles changed everything. After that, that's the delineation point. If it sounds more like the Beatles and more like garage rock, then it doesn't belong on these. It belongs on a different CD, you know. I'm trying to show you how it's more was back in those days, you know, the 50s, which unfortunately just hasn't gotten any juice at all as far as promotion goes, or CDs or anything else. So I thought it was about time to hopefully fix that. And a lot of times, I've seen a couple other alleged Chicago rock and roll CDs that came out, but they were all over the map. They were downstate Illinois and Indiana and this and that. Yeah, that's not Chicago. That's somewhere else. You know, that's another interesting thing. You could do different CDs of that, but it doesn't fit this in my vision. So
sure.
Somebody was giving me grief on Facebook the other day because, oh, so-and-so wasn't from Chicago. No, but he lived up here for quite a while, you know, while he was performing up here, and here is where he recorded. And therefore, I consider him part of the Eddie Cash comes to mind in that realm. He eventually went out to Vegas as an Elvis imitator for many years.
Bill, thank you so much for this fabulous CD. It's delightful to listen to.
Glad you like it. It was a labor of love because, you know, I mean, it sold real well around here from what I can see. Like Dusty Groove had it. I hadn't gotten my copies yet, so I bought one there. And then a month later, I went back and they were all gone. So people must have bought it. I did Steve King and Johnny Putman's show, and that probably helped clear them out. But I noticed right like a couple days ago, Bear Family said, oh, you're on for volume two, blah, 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 blah. So I thought, well, something must be getting back to them. It's selling. So that was interesting. But second one will have a lot of the same artists. Oh, thank you. It holds together pretty well. Of course, I had 6 years to work on it because I kept trying to perfect it and kept trying to perfect it. You know, I kept diddling with the liner notes and let's move a word here and a graph there and move it around. And so this next one won't have 6 years. It'll have more like 6 months. So, you know, let's hope that it sticks together the same way. There'll be a few new acts along. There's only one Elwood Twinkie, God knows. So that was it. So
yeah.
The Cinderella. That one may not have been done in Chicago. That's the one ringer, because even though the label actually helpfully lists all the musicians on it, the drummer told me that in reality, Elwood, who was the bass player, Earl Hensley in Ral's band, that was Ral's band, he snuck off to Nashville to record it. So it may not have been there, but I let it slide because it's never been on anything. And God, in Cinderella Twist, as I said in the notes, go on the internet and see Ral Donner do the same song on a 7-minute short called Twist Craze, produced by none other than Jim Lounsbury. And he does a great version of it, but he never put it on a record. And I imagine that's why Earl did it. So it needs to be somewhere. So that's why it's on there.
We have to kind of wrap it up here. We're running out of time with such great stories you're telling about everything. Lifelong Chicago resident, you're telling about your writing professionally and your compilations you're putting together and everything like that. And we in Northwest Indiana kind of consider us part of the Chicago scene, but I understand the delineation there. So that's Bill Dahl, and he's Grammy nominated for his writing for liner notes and a whole wide range of things, The Art of the Blues and A Visual Treasury and everything. Thank you so much for coming on Art of the Air and sharing your wonderful storied history.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
This is Adam of The Empty Pockets, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We would like to welcome Jason Sturgill to Art on the Air. Jason is an artist who wants to challenge the viewer to gaze longer at art, longer than the 6 seconds he claims is the average time of looking. He strives to add movement into all of his pieces. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Jason. It's really nice meeting you.
Bonjour and guten tag, and hello from Kentucky. It's nice meeting both of you as well.
And guten tag to you also. Well, Jason, how we always start out in interviews is getting your origin story, where you grew up and everything. Like, I always like to say, how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about Jason.
I got 23 minutes left to give you the cliff notes. First off, I was raised in Virginia. I'm a mountain boy. I grew up on the top of the mountain, very much an Appalachian upbringing. Had three brothers, loads of cousins that would live with us. My dad was a miner. My mom worked from home. And, we just had a good upbringing. Fun times, always outdoors, always, exploring, the world around us. I eventually got into music. I've really been sketching all my life, but got into music as a side gig and really got into it for a while. And then that landed me in college. So in college, I started taking some art classes, learning that, I could do this, and then wound up becoming an art teacher. So I've pretty much been teaching for the last 24 years. And now I'm trying to make a good run toward my retirement by working the side gig as a freelance artist and doing and trying to learn the world of the art field. So here we are.
So when did the music start? What was schooling like? Were there a lot of art and music in the school? Was your family musical?
My family was, my dad was a football player. That's what Appalachia was known for. And then my mom loved singing. She was not trained by any means, but she loved, singing church hymnals and just singing along with the radio. And, that was always in my life. My brother is the one who got into music first, my older brother. 5 years older than me, started playing. And then my parents saw the value in it and then pushed me into doing that. And, my little brother after me did the same thing. So three of the four of us were actually in musical things over our career. And then I went on to college, got a music degree first, and then I've gotten four art degrees afterwards, two different masters and two more bachelor's degrees.
So were you all playing the same instrument, or did you choose different instruments?
My brother started on baritone euphonium. Then wound up playing tuba. I started on trombone and then wound up playing tuba. And I've traveled the world playing tuba. I've been all through the country, north, south, been to China. So it's taken me a lot of fun places. And then my little brother just basically played tuba most of his life.
Your music, while that seemed like a major part of it, how did you settle into, getting your master's in art, but then finding teaching? And, what do you teach, college, high school, or tell us about that?
So go back to the previous question. There was not art in school in Virginia. There was a high school art class, but the art teacher at that time was an English professor or an English teacher. He was taught one class of art, and then he retired the year that I was going to take art. So I never had any kind of formal training in school. So I always drew. I always painted. There's a fun story out there about a teacher who pulled my dad in, woke him up, made him come to school and have a parent meeting because I was always drawing in class. And, basically he grabbed my sketchbook and told me to tell the teacher what she was teaching that day. And I kind of like out of almost a scene out of like old school, the movie where Will Ferrell just starts reciting things. That's what I did. So my dad knew at that point that I should be drawing in class, even though I didn't have any education and teachers to teach me that I should be involved in that. So become a part of my plan. And then voila, drawing ever since. So when I got to college, I took a class just to see if I could do it, fell in love with it, and then haven't turned back.
So for you, has it always been drawing?
I've carved and whittled, and I really am a dabbler. If you look at my studio, I have carving tools and computer art, you know, computer work. I'm currently right now doing a lot of modeling and modeling clay, and then doing 3D scanning and printing those out. So, I mean, I just dabble in a lot of stuff. I love to print make. I actually was just teaching a class to other teachers about printmaking and different ways you can do printmaking. So, I love art. I love doing artistic things. And on top of that, I just love learning new stuff. And then as I learn it, I love giving it to other people so that they can use it as well.
So then you, when you teach, you finally landed a teaching job, I'm assuming school. Tell us the challenges of teaching art. I mean, a lot of times kids come into those types of classes is like, okay, then, you know, this is not my math. And they consider it a blow off. But how do you find the student that really takes that seriously versus the one that says, okay, I just need to check this box?
I've taught for a long time and taught a lot of different students. In rural areas and now in more of an urban setting in Lexington. And finding a path to kids is what we do, you know, and trying to find a way to get them to succeed. If I came in every class period cookie cutter wise and was like, all right, we're all going to do this and you're going to do it my way, and that's it.
Yeah, zero then, engagement.
You know, you're not going to find those kids. Right. So, but if you come in and you start them all in the same spot, and then you allow them, and I use this a lot, especially with my older students and my college students, about trying to create a journey for them and trying to, I'm going to walk the journey with you. I'm going to guide you. I'm going to give you some feedback. But what we do in these classes is, you know, I'm learning from you, you're learning from me, but we're taking this journey together. And just like any good voyage, whether you're climbing Mount Everest or just going to the store, you know, you always want to go with someone and you want to do that with someone. And that's my job, is to walk that with them, you know, encourage them sometimes, praise them sometimes, and sometimes just keep my mouth shut and let them learn. You know, because failure is also one of the greatest teachers, and you got to let people fall on their face and then struggle a little bit, but then wait for them to ask for help. And as a teacher, and as a firstborn, I want to jump in sometimes and do that. And I got to step back and say, hey, you know, you fall on your face. All right. Pick yourself up a little bit. And then we'll kind of go from there. And, you know, if I see that they're not, then I encourage them. But if they rebound, then I've done my job.
So, Jason, are you able to carve out time for your own personal work while you're teaching? I know that, like, you know, in making lesson plans, I expended so much artistic energy that sometimes there wasn't enough time or desire for me to work on my own personal art.
And that's the great thing about, you know, being a working artist as well, is that you're not having to sit all the time lesson planning per se, and like, oh, I don't know how to print make, so I need to watch 15 videos on how to print make and do this and do that and do this and do that. You know, I did that already. Like, I know that stuff forwards and backwards. I don't want to sound egotistical by any means, but, you know, when I was in college, I spent a couple extra years doing those things just so that I wouldn't be in that situation where I'd have to be sitting, writing out, you know, lesson plans and doing all this research and this and that. And, I've also learned over the years, sometimes you got to put that back on the kids, you know, and that's a part of the learning experience, is have open-ended questions and let those kids, you know, fill in the blank. Because as 1/8 of any, like, student's journey per day or per, you know, every other day, you know, I've got to be able to let them experience art and experience their creativity, you know, without me just sitting there bonking them over the head and saying, do this, do that.
You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
So I'm looking at a horse head. It's one of the images you sent us. How would you describe what your art is? I mean, I know this is just one example of your 2D art, but how would you explain that, what you do?
So we'll take a trip back. 2014, I started... 2013, I saw an artist online who was doing basically a drawing a day challenge. He was a comic artist, and every day he would just sit down and draw either a head or draw a little thing, and had a moleskin journal and would just do, you know, fun little doodles and stuff like that. And I shared it with one of my kids, and then one of my kids challenged me, and he was going to do it, and I was going to do it together. And we would just do a drawing a day, try to figure something out. And about that same time, I was really kind of pigeonholed into creating a certain way and drawing a certain way and things being, you know, picture perfect or realistic or, you know, even high realistic. And I was like, you know, this is doable, but I don't know if it's sustainable. I wasn't really creating anything. I was just basically a glorified copy machine at that point. So in that, that journey, that drawing a day, I just started throwing every little medium and technique and, you know, whatever at a page and trying new stuff every day. And then, lo and behold, this technique came about. I was mixing watercolor and ink and several different types of drawing styles all in one, you know, one composition, and creating something that was ethereal. It was more of an experience than a than just an image. It kind of resembles stained glass a little bit, but it's also, I mean, just watercolor, and you know, it's storytell sometimes, and other times it's you know, find some hidden things in it. But I tell people when I talk to them in my space and when I do galleries that you know, I'm here to create an experience for you, something that's everlasting. I don't want you to look at this piece and be able to remember it and draw it. I want you to be able to look at this piece and go, oh, that's unique, but then see it in 2 weeks and have a completely different response and a completely different rationale on why you love that.
Well, one of them I'm looking at right now, and it's either a young woman or young man walking down a street in front of a row of houses, but then sketch, and you know, very, very colorful, but sketch very thinly in there are like creatures and everything, like following that person. I can't tell if it's a young man or a young woman, but it doesn't really matter. The thing is you're looking at that and you're saying, oh, there's all these very sketched in creatures. So tell us a little bit about that piece.
That one's called You Will Never Walk Alone. The young person is, you know, latchkey kid, having to go to school, walk by themselves. But the people that are sketched in are kind of washed out a little bit. Those are the imaginary friends and the company that this person keeps, as opposed to, you know, having that best friend to walk with them. This person's best friends are the characters that they have created. So if you look deeply, there's like an ogre in there, and there's a dragon up in the corner, and then there's just different random characters that this person has attached himself to. You can call them imaginary friends, but, you know, those are the creations and the fun things that, you know, that young person has created and will take with them the rest of their life. That piece actually sits in a larger set of pieces based around what's called a Garden of Childish Dreams. And that looked at all the goofy things we would do as a kid. And then it wound up the last piece in the show, which was the showcase piece, was a kid sitting with their VR glasses on with all this technology, robots galore. And mom and dad is in the background all dressed up going out of the town. And it was called Techno Babysitter. And it was kind of the harsh reality that we're sitting in now, is that these kids nowadays are missing these wonderful, you know, lively, fun, imaginative things because they're being force-fed stuff, you know, through technology.
Well, what I was going to ask is, you have seemed like you've already touched a lot of different mediums that you use for your art, but is there something that you have not explored that you want to do? That's like something, oh, I've never done, and whatever that is. I mean, you've touched on, you've done some 3D with clay and things, but is there something that you would have liked to try and do, like oils or something else?
Man, that's a hard question. like I print make already. I do acrylic painting and oil painting. You know, definitely watercolor. I sculpt. I used to whittle when I was younger. That's kind of where I got some of my fun artistic prowess, was just taking a piece of wood and a pocket knife and trying to carve little characters and stuff out of them. I have done like big firings with people, ceramic firings, but also brass pourings and stuff like that. I would like to do that more. I would love to be able to do sculpture full time. I'm also not really good at welding, so that's something else that I would eventually like to get into, is do more, you know, figurative work, realistic, or, you know, even, you know, hyper realistic, made out of metal and stuff like that. So that's the next evolution of where Sturgill wants to go.
Mm-hmm. You still keep up with music?
Yeah, I play on a regular basis. I lost my brother in January. He was the one that kind of spearheaded me into playing and kind of kept me motivated. And I've actually taken the year off from playing, but I do play with, like, play music with several different ensembles in the area. And, you know, I have one coming up this summer that I'll try to get back into playing. Yeah, but I miss it when I don't play. I miss the fact that I'm not honoring him when I don't play, because he gave up a lot. And I've kind of lived for him in some ways, you know, through that. So, and, it's keeping his memory alive too.
Yeah.
Yeah. How did you get connected for the Love Art Fair? I think you and I talked about before we started, this is your fourth year, or you've been doing it for 4 years. And how'd you connect with Shireen and get involved with that?
Through Ann Clam. First off, I'm a Kentucky Crafted juried member here in Kentucky. That's a big program that we that the state of Kentucky has. That's you know, jury process. So I got involved in that first, and then Ann started throwing out some names, and my name came up. And then she Ann brought Shireen down and took us, you know, brought her to some of the art shows that I was at. So we met up that way. And then, you know, I thought it was a great place to go, and I like South Bend. So that's why we came up that direction.
We like being indoors versus being outdoors. It's always a nice, nice environment. Yeah. And we've had Ann on the show.
So much more fun to.
Yeah. We've had Ann on the show also a couple of years ago. So we do several of these types of interviews and everything. So what can we expect to see at for the Love Art Fair of your artwork?
We have some new pieces, all storytelling pieces. I didn't really mention that a whole bunch, but I do a lot of storytelling. That's a part of the Appalachian background. I grew up with a lot of storytellers, big fish story people, and, you know, people who could just tell wild, fun tales. And then, yeah, I do that now with my artwork. But, you know, you'll see the storytelling pieces. I've ventured into some more abstraction work. These are pieces based around music. So one of the fun things, and I'm trying to wrap this up, but I have a fun form of chromesthesia, or synesthesia, called chromesthesia, where I see imagery and sound. So as a musician, I have to have a story to tell when I play, and when I do artwork, I have to have music going on as well to keep things fun and you know, lively. So you'll see some pieces like that, and then I do have some dancers this year as well. But. That I was working on. So I've got some different dancers. There's several troops here in our town, you know, in Lexington. I'll go and visit and sketch off of them, and then bring them back in the studio and rework them.
What are the sizes of the pieces? We see the illustrations here that you sent us, but what are generally your sizes, and what sizes will be available at the art fair?
I usually have 18 by 24s. I do have prints of pretty much all my work, except for something that maybe is brand new. I also sell coloring books. I've ripped the color out of the imagery and made coloring books. So those will be sold at the show as well. And then I do have some that are 24 by 36. And then I do go down as far as 9 by 12, but I haven't brought those out, you know, in the last 6 months. So probably won't bring them this time around either.
And do you sell prints of your work? I mean, not just the originals, but you have like prints? Oh, okay. Very good. And we're in about our last 2 minutes here, but I want to give you a chance to maybe say future art exhibits you have at past for the Love of Art Fair, where would people expect to see you like in the rest of 2026?
2026, I'm actually pulling back a little bit on art shows. Kentucky Crafted will be the next one after for the Love of Art, because I'm actually working on creating a graphic novel based around Appalachian myths. So I've been writing Jack tales and looking at different creatures like Bigfoot and the Wampus Cat and the Tallipo, and just, you know, diving into these different mythological creatures from Appalachia, and we tell.
Oh, it sounds so exciting! Style,
so it is, and I'm self-publishing. So when I get it done, I'll let you guys know that when it's out there. But yeah, my wife keeps telling me to pull back, and I've already set out 10 chapters a piece, and she's like, good Lord. Like, honey, this is my retirement. That's what we're going to do.
Well, in our final minute, how people can find you online, reach out to you and everything. And I don't know if you do commissions, maybe someone would like you to do that.
Yeah. So you can go to Google, type in Xenosketch, X-E-N-O, and then the word sketch, all one word. And it'll pull up my Instagram, my Facebook. My daily sketches is out there as well. It's on Facebook. And then I also have a dedicated web page, and the URL is pretty long, so that's why I say go to Google and just type in Xenosketch, and then it'll say Xenosketch, the art of Jason Sturgill, and that is me and my artistic journey there.
Excellent. Well, we'll have on your picture on our website, we'll take a link to Xenosketch. Our guest today was Jason Sturgill. He'll be at For the Love of Art Fair February 7th, 8th, and that's at South Bend Century Center. If you get a chance, you can pop by and see his work in person and chat with him. Thank you so much for coming on Art of the Air and sharing your arts and actual music journey, too. We really appreciate it.
Not a problem. Thank you all very much.
Yeah, all the best, Jason. Thank you so much.
Not a problem. Thank you.
We'd like to thank our guest this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Dee Dotson, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Media, and to Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Ember Forge Consulting. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or send us information about your arts, arts-related event or exhibit, please email us at AOTA@breck.com. That's AOTA@breck.com. BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air, our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. Show the world.